Hello, folks. Welcome to the August 2015 edition of First Thursday. This is Labor Relations Information Systems monthly podcast, where we try to bring you up to date on developments of significance in the last 30 days or so in the public safety labor relations workplace. My name is Will Aitchison. I'm the director of LRAS and the host of the podcast. Now, normally on these podcasts, we'll have sort of a potpourri of different things. I might talk about settlement trends that are out there and collective bargaining agreements or potential rulemaking from the Department of Labor, whatever it might be. Today, though, is just going to be chock full of case law. It seems like the courts are almost kind of clearing out a lot of backlog in the middle of the summer, and we've seen case after case that has a lot of significance come down from courts around the country. I've picked seven of them to talk about in this podcast, so I better get to it right away. But before I do, I wanted to alert you to a special podcast that will air sometime in the next 2 weeks or so. I'll be interviewing Steve Bucati. Steve is a lawyer in Kansas who represents law enforcement labor organizations there. And he was one of the lawyers on what I think of as a very, very significant Brady case. It involved, actually, there's a couple of cases. They're kind of companion cases. They involve some Kansas police officers who were fired for dishonesty. And Steve and I will talk about how the Brady list has come to live and breathe in Kansas, what an arbitrator did in these cases, and what we're looking for in the future. It's really, I think, a pretty significant development that we're seeing where for the first time, and I think it's only been in the last year or so, for the first time we are seeing from arbitrators and from courts the notion of gradations of untruthfulness in the law enforcement workplace. That didn't used to be the case, right? The old adage that law enforcement officers got in training was, if you lied, you were done. Your career was over. And now what we see are arbitrators and courts looking at, I think, and they don't all say it out loud, looking at the harshness of the Brady rule, this whole notion that you don't just forfeit your job if you lie, you may forfeit any future employment opportunities as a law enforcement officer, looking at the harshness of that and saying, well, maybe we only want to apply that sort of principle in the most serious of untruthfulness cases. Anyway, and I don't want to steal too much of the thunder from that podcast that'll be coming up. Steve can talk about that very, very well. Just wanted to alert you that that podcast will be coming. The first case I want to talk about is actually not one case, it's four. They're all on the same thing, and it's on a rule called the firefighter's rule. I haven't talked about this, I think, ever on the podcast, and I don't think too many people really understand the firefighter's rule and what it means. And so I wanted to spend a little bit of time on it because there have been a bunch of decisions this year on the firefighters' rule, and that rule still, at least in some places, is alive and well. So what is this thing? What is firefighters' rule? Well, it's been with us for more than 100 years. It comes courtesy of a decision from the Illinois Supreme Court. I think it was in the 1890s or so. And the whole notion was that firefighters, and originally it only applied to firefighters, that firefighters would be treated less generously by the courts if they were filing a negligence lawsuit against somebody whose negligence caused them injuries on the job. So, for example, let's say you have a landowner or something like that, and there's fire on the scene, and the landowner has a wide open pit in their backyard that is terribly dangerous. A firefighter comes onto the scene in the middle of the night, falls in the pit, and injures themselves. Now, if it was me in somebody's backyard in the middle of the night, and don't ask what I would be doing in somebody's backyard in the middle of the night, I don't think I'd be there, but if it was me, I could probably sue the landowner for negligence for having that open pit and not warning people, but not a firefighter. And the notion was that firefighters come onto people's land. They are employed as, and you see this rule sometimes referred to as, professional rescuers, sometimes called the professional rescuers rule. And over time, courts have come up with three theories that deny firefighters the ability to sue third parties whose negligence causes them injury on the job. Here are the three theories. First of all, the jobs of firefighters are inherently hazardous because they often enter property at unforeseen times and can be forced to go into back rooms and other unusual parts of a premises that might not be generally open to the public and do so under emergency conditions. Therefore, they shouldn't be able to sue for negligence associated with those areas or those hazardous conditions. The second justification is that firefighters voluntarily choose their professions and by implication assume the risk of all hazards of the job. And the third, and hold on to your hat on this one, I can imagine you're not going to be very happy when you hear this, is that the public already compensates firefighters for undertaking all of these expanded risks in the form of higher salaries and more readily available workers' comp benefits. So those are the three rationales for the firefighters' rule. In some states, you see an emphasis on one of the rationales. Other states cite all three. And over time, the firefighters' rule has come to be applied to police officers as well as firefighters. So, for example, a police officer stopping a motorist who is stranded for whatever reason, and a third car comes by and hits the police officer. There are some states where that officer couldn't sue the person who struck him because of the firefighters' rule. Now, this is an extraordinarily harsh rule. It treats police officers and firefighters less generously in the civil courts than any other type of employee. And there's been a lot of debate about whether or not we should continue this rule. Some state legislatures, for example, Minnesota, have actually statutorily repealed the firefighters' rule. Courts in other states, Oregon and Colorado come to mind, have decided there's no longer any valid rationale for the firefighters' rule. But even still today, the majority of courts follow the firefighters' rule. It's a shrinking majority, but it is still a clear majority. All right, that's the firefighters' rule. What have we seen in 2015 from the courts on the firefighters' rule? And here's where I want to talk about these four cases. The first of them comes from the Kansas Court of Appeals, and the Kansas courts had never decided whether or not police officers should also be covered by the firefighters' rule, and the Court of Appeals ends up saying, yeah, it should. What's the rationale for the Court of Appeals? The rationale is, look, we know we're treating firefighters pretty badly here. It's not fair to treat police officers less badly. No, I'm not kidding. Let me give you the exact quote from the court. As public safety officers, both firefighters and law enforcement officers are called upon to respond to a wide range of emergencies in their official capacities. They do not do so because of any private duty owed to an individual, but because of their official capacity and their sworn duty to the public as a whole. Like firefighters, law enforcement officers are employed at the taxpayer's expense for the express purpose of dealing with such emergencies. Here it comes. Get ready. We should have a drum roll for this. it would be fundamentally unfair to allow a law enforcement officer to seek to recover damages from one who causes an automobile accident, but deny this right to a firefighter while responding to the same accident. In other words, our laws treat firefighters badly, so therefore we should treat police officers badly. Now the court goes on to say, look, we understand some people have questioned the viability of the firefighters' rule. However, we're just a court of appeals, and we have to do what our Supreme Court says. And our Supreme Court has held, not all that recently, that the firefighter rules is the public policy of the state of Kansas. It's kind of an invitation, I think, to both the Kansas Supreme Court to perhaps reconsider the firefighters' rule, or maybe a spur to the Kansas legislature to consider abolishing it. And legislatures can abolish the firefighters' rule. Okay, second case. This one comes out of Pennsylvania, and it's another police officer case. This is an officer who's responding to a disturbance call in a bar. And while he's attempting to intervene, he encounters an intoxicated patron who was busy groping female patrons, drinking other people's drinks, and kind of being generally physically confrontational. The patron, when the officer intervenes, assaults the officer. The officer then sues the bar owner. No good suing the patron, right? He probably doesn't have any money. Sues the bar owner for negligence. What's the negligence? Serving an obviously intoxicated individual an alcoholic beverage. What does the court end up saying? Court throws out the lawsuit. This is a Pennsylvania's Commonwealth Court, which is kind of like its Court of Appeals. It says that under the firefighter's rule, the bar owner only had to warn the officer of dangerous hidden conditions. And since the police officer was on the scene responding to a call about an intoxicated suspect, that wasn't a dangerous hidden condition. Therefore, no obligation on the part of the bar owner to do anything more, and the firefighter's rule ends the lawsuit. Third case comes out of California. It's another police case. And this is one from a Los Angeles County deputy sheriff. He's off duty. And he's off duty in a restaurant with his kids. And I think there were some friends that were involved. And also, he had his nephews along with him. The deputy gets into a confrontation in the parking lot of this restaurant with a suspect. The suspect had been, again, generally unruly, and at one point had pushed one of the deputy's nephews. The deputy then places the suspect under arrest, but while he's doing so, he's stabbed. The deputy files a workers' comp claim, and in the course of the workers' comp claim, is able to successfully establish that he was on duty because he was making an arrest, and therefore he should be entitled to workers' comp benefits. He then turns around and sues the restaurant and also the person who stabbed him, and the defense from the restaurant is firefighter's rule. The deputy's answer is, what do you mean firefighter's rule? I was off duty. The California Court of Appeals said, well, might have thought you were off duty, but then you filed that workers' comp claim and successfully established that it was a duty-related injury. Therefore, you were on duty. Therefore, you're subject to the firefighter's rule, and therefore, you can't sue the restaurant for negligence. The fourth case I want to talk about is a little bit different twist on this. And this is a Connecticut case, and it involves the question of whether privately employed paramedics who have no firefighters' duties, whether or not they should be subject to the firefighters' rule. This is a paramedic who was injured when One of the outside steps of a building gave way underneath him. The paramedic sues the building owner, claiming the steps were defective and highly dangerous, and that the building owner could have or should have known about this dangerous condition. And, of course, the building owner raises the firefighter's rule as a defense. The Connecticut court ends up deciding against expanding the firefighter's rule to cover privately employed paramedics. And listen to the court's opinion, because it reiterates one of those three central underpinnings to the firefighter's rule. Here's what the court says. The public should and does compensate its safety officers both in pay that reflects the hazard of their work and in workers' comp benefits for injuries suffered when the risks inherent in the occupation materialize. But in this case, the court says none of that applies because the paramedic is not a public employee. And therefore, the notion that the public is paying for police officers and firefighters, for example, to assume the risk, doesn't apply in the case of a privately employed paramedic. So, I think what you see in courts right now is just a kind of a widespread unease with the firefighter's rule. Not going so far in recent years as to repeal it. Those Oregon and Colorado cases I was talking about, they're 20 years old, but courts are just plainly unhappy with this. Why are they unhappy with it? Because if you think of all those rationales for the firefighter's rule, you know, we pay people good benefits, we provide them with workers' compensation insurance, and you know, they're public employees. Those rationales apply to a whole lot more people than just firefighters and police officers. They apply to pretty much every public employee, not just public employees, right? Aren't all employees covered by workers' compensation insurance? There's a wonderful dissent in a California case from one of the greatest state court judges ever, California Supreme Court justice named Matthew Tabriner. And he dissented from the adoption of the firefighters' rule in California. And this is all by recollection, by the way, so I'm probably making 90% of this up. And what he said in his dissenting opinion was, you know, the rationales for the firefighters' rule, they prove too much. They prove too much because so many different employees could be analyzed under exactly the same rationale. Why are we treating police and fire less generously? One last word about this, and as you can tell, I feel kind of strongly about this one. I've never understood how in this day and age we can have a rule like this. One last word. This is an area where management and labor should be approaching state legislatures jointly. You can understand why a labor union would want the firefighter rule repealed. I mean, workers' comp benefits, while nice, they don't adequately compensate for many injuries. Why would management want it repealed? Because if you think about it, management is bearing all of the costs of firefighter and police officer on-the-job injuries. Without the firefighter's rule, firefighters and police officers could sue these negligent third parties. And the city or county or district that employed them could have a claim against the negligent third party for the amount of the workers' compensation benefits that were paid. In other words, it's to the advantage of an employer to not have a firefighter's rule. It's one of these cases where management and labor's interests really coalesce. I just think they need to focus on it more. This is something that you don't really pay much attention to until you have the horrific case, the guy stabbed in the parking lot, where there's no basis to recover beyond workers' compensation. All right, I know that was pretty arcane, and sorry about that, but I do think that's important. Let's move on to the FLSA, because there's a kind of an interesting case You hear a chuckle in my voice about this one because it's something that I've lived through several times. What happens when there's a FLSA violation that's embedded in a payroll system? You know, I've always thought that from a collective bargaining standpoint, and my day job is that of representing unions, particularly representing unions, I've always thought that the event that I would least like to see is an employer changing its payroll system. It is the most incredibly disruptive event that really occurs in management and labor's relationship. Well, maybe not the most incredibly disruptive, but it's pretty horrible. And it's made all the more horrible when you see employers, or more likely the vendors of these payroll systems, saying, look, you have to adapt your practices to our payroll system rather than vice versa. And that just drives me wacko when that happens. You can just predict you're going to see dozens and dozens of grievances. And believe it or not, arbitrators actually find that a collective bargaining agreement supersedes the whims of a payroll system vendor. But, okay, I'm off on an aside. Sometimes, many times, I have seen payroll systems, electronic payroll systems, purchased that have embedded FLSA violations in them. Usually it's in the way the regular rate of pay is calculated under the FLSA. Overtime is time and a half the regular rate of pay, not the hourly rate. But sometimes there's other violations that are built in. Is that a defense? Well, there's a case out of Lackawanna County in Pennsylvania where a court just had to consider this. This involves a group of deputy sheriffs. And among their FLSA claims was that they had worked overtime for which they simply hadn't been compensated. And in fact, in the lawsuit, the county admits that that had occurred and also admitted that the deputies had recorded the time in the electronic payroll system for the employer, but that due to a fault in the payroll system, the deputies didn't get paid. And in the lawsuit, the county's defense was, look, we didn't have any reason to know that this overtime was being worked. We didn't have, in the parlance of the FLSA, actual or constructive knowledge of unpaid overtime hours. It was just in this payroll system that there was that information, and therefore we shouldn't have to pay for the overtime. The answer from the federal court was, and I'm just paraphrasing a little bit, are you kidding? No. Well, it actually was just about that harsh. The court says, look, you bought this payroll system. You used it. You have acknowledged that the deputies worked the overtime hours and weren't paid in accordance with the FLSA. And the fact that your computer system did not recognize the overtime issue, that's irrelevant. Now, quoting from the court, the computer payroll system's deficiencies in not properly recognizing that an employee worked overtime doesn't excuse the county's failure to pay its employees overtime. The county's failure to acquire and utilize a payroll system that would recognize overtime does not excuse the county from its FLSA obligations. Since everybody agrees, says the court, that the deputy worked overtime, they're entitled to compensation for that. And I'd say there's not a whole lot of cases about this, about how payroll systems overlap with the FLSA. But I will say I think this court's decision is smack in the middle of what you could expect other courts to do. The fact is, the obligation here is the employer's. And part of that obligation, when you've got an electronic payroll system, is making sure that you have an electronic payroll system that actually works and complies with the FLSA. Next case is a disciplinary case. It comes to us courtesy of the Massachusetts courts, and it addresses a question you see come up with some frequency. And the question is this: is it possible for a union to file a grievance when an employee has been placed on administrative leave with pay? Not without pay, but with pay. And the answer that the Massachusetts courts and an arbitrator give, and I've seen this answer in other forums as well, is yeah, it is possible depending upon some circumstances. So let's talk about this case. This case comes up in 2011, and it involves the city of Waltham, Massachusetts, the police department there, and an officer by the name of Paul Tracy. Tracy is asked by a friend to help him obtain information from tenants he was trying to evict from an apartment that the friend's family owned in Waltham. And Tracy accompanied the friend to the apartment. Apparently Tracy was on duty. It's not quite clear from the court's opinion that that is the case, but I think that's a fair implication. He accompanies the friend to the apartment, and they get information from the tenants, including a fellow by the name of Edgar Gonzalez. After Tracy left the apartment, and he did nothing more than get the information, Gonzalez immediately began complaining to the police that he'd been threatened with eviction and deportation if he didn't leave the apartment, and he requested an investigation. The police department immediately puts Tracy on administrative leave, paid administrative leave, while an internal affairs investigation is ongoing. The administrative leave lasts 6 months, and then at the end of 6 months, the city decides that Tracy is guilty of violating some of its rules and suspends him for 15 days without pay. That suspension ends, of course, the administrative leave. Tracy comes back to work, but in the meantime, his union, the Massachusetts Coalition of Police, challenged both the suspension and Tracy's placement on administrative leave in arbitration. And an arbitrator ended up finding, first of all, that Tracy didn't do anything wrong in the encounter with Gonzalez, and that he should not have been suspended, and also that the city didn't wrongfully place him on administrative leave, but basically owed Tracy money by virtue of the fact that he was placed on administrative leave. The city gets that arbitrator's decision and decides we're not going to comply with it and challenges it in court, and that gets us to the Massachusetts Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals turns away the city's challenge and upholds the arbitrator's opinion. And what the court ends up saying is, first of all, consider how this case comes to us. It comes to us as an appeal from an arbitrator's decision. That means we're bound by the arbitrator's factual findings and his conclusions of law, even if they're wrong. And what are the factual findings in this case? The factual findings were that there was only one technical violation of the department's rules in which Tracy engaged: his failure to call into the dispatch center before he made the visit to the friend's apartment, or somehow otherwise make a record of the visit to apartment. The arbitrator says the court, the city's investigation as unusually and unnecessarily long, indicates that all of the investigations were complete more than 5 months before the city imposed the suspension, and the arbitrator ended up concluding that the city violated the contract by arbitrarily and capriciously maintaining Tracy on administrative leave, an action that was also effectively discipline without just cause. So what does the court do with all that? The court said that's within the arbitrator's authority. When you give the arbitrator a question of whether or not there's just cause for discipline or just cause for the placement on the administrative leave, you've given the arbitrator the authority to answer the question. And quoting from the court, the arbitrator didn't disturb the decision of the chief to place Tracy on administrative leave or order him to end the leave or otherwise interfere with his duties at any time during the IA investigation. All he did was to say that the placement on leave violated the contract and imposed a remedy for that. And the court says that an arbitrator can do. So what's the remedy for someone who's wrongfully placed on administrative leave? And there's not much of a discussion in it in the Tracy case, but I've seen the discussion a bunch of times, and the remedy is pretty much all the same. And the question is, what economic harm did the employee suffer from the placement on administrative leave? So, for example, was the employee formerly working a shift to which shift differential attached, where it did not attach when the employee was placed on administrative leave? What about the opportunity to work overtime? Had this employee on a routine and fairly predictable basis worked overtime in the past? Was the employee denied the opportunity to work the overtime while on administrative leave? You ask those sorts of questions as to whether or not there was economic harm. And if you answer any of them yes, then the remedy for being inappropriately placed on administrative leave is a make-whole remedy. Pay the overtime that the employee would have worked, but for the placement on administrative leave, pay the shift differential, pay the premium holiday, whatever it might be that the employee lost by virtue of the inappropriate placement on administrative leave. Our next case is also a discipline case, comes out of California. You know, normally I try to keep these podcasts to case law involving public safety employees, but every once in a while there's a case that comes up that doesn't involve public safety employees, involves some other public employees, and it just is too important to overlook. And that's the case here with, it's a case that comes out of the Foothill Dianza, it's a community college district in California, and the union that is involved is a teachers union, the faculty association there. Here's the question that is eventually answered by an administrative law judge for California's Public Employment Relations Board. The question is this, and you see this come up with some regularity. Is there any privacy interest on the part of an employee who is complaining against a fellow employee? So if I'm an employee and I file a complaint, say I'll make it a dicey one, a sexual harassment complaint. I'm filing a sexual harassment complaint against a fellow employee. Do I have the right to claim a privacy interest in my complaint such that the details of the complaint, my name, the date that I filed the complaint, what my specific allegations were, the document on which I prepared the complaint, if it's a written complaint, such that those details will not be provided to the person I am accusing? Now that's the question here. This is a case that involves a coach. He's the male tennis coach, and he's the subject actually of a couple of complaints from fellow employees about misconduct, and it's kind of harassment sort of misconduct. The community college district launches an IA investigation. Immediately, the union asks for a copy of the complaint. In the system they've got in this district, it was an informal type complaint. And the employer not only said, no, you can't have a copy of the complaint, but also said, we're not going to give you additional information concerning the nature of the allegations. And that prompted an unfair labor practice complaint from the Faculty Association, basically saying, look, in order for us to exercise our rights as the exclusive bargaining representative for the coach and other people in the bargaining unit, we need to be able to have access to the full files in disciplinary cases. And it's kind of sort of a Weingarten derivative right, but it also is a right that simply arises out of the union status as the exclusive bargaining representative. And here's what the administrative law judge says. The ALJ starts with the proposition that a union is entitled to all information that is necessary and relevant to the discharge of its duty of fair representation, and that the failure by an employer to provide that information is a per se violation of the duty to bargain in good faith. The ALJ says there's only a couple exceptions to this rule of broad disclosure. And one is, are there going to be burdensome costs that would be imposed on an employer? In the case of that exception, we might sit down and talk about who's going to bear those costs. Or if the release would of the information would inappropriately compromise privacy rights. And the ALJ then turns to the heart of the case, and that is, does a complainant have a privacy right such that a complaint like this does not need to be disclosed? And the ALJ says no privacy rights. And the ALJ repeatedly draws analogies to what would happen if this were in the court system. And in the court system, all of this is on the record. You can obtain discovery of all this information. You mean you could be deposing the taking the deposition of a complainant, and you could be getting all this information. And the ALJ just constantly comes back to that. Here's what the ALJ ultimately concludes, and I'm quoting now for a little bit. It's clear that as with civil litigation, it's neither reasonable nor required that witness contact information be kept confidential from the representative of the accused when defending against workplace misconduct allegations. Rather, the identification of witnesses is central to the discovering process and a routine and essential part of the unions to represent its members. So the ALJ says, look, there might be an exceptional case where this sort of complaint would generate some sort of privacy interest. An exceptional case. But this isn't one. And here are the concluding words from the ALJ, and I think these words really seal the deal. Ultimately, while employees generally have a legally protected privacy interest in their home addresses and contact information, they do not have a right or even an objectively reasonable expectation of anonymity from their union when filing workplace misconduct complaints against coworkers. So, in other words, this is an argument. You see it made sometimes by employers in sensitive cases like the sexual harassment setting that I gave you. This is an argument that's not likely to be recognized should the matter be heard by a labor board. Let's stay in California now, and let's talk about an on-duty affair and privacy rights. And I got to give you a little bit of background before I talk about this case. One of the most important cases in the area of privacy rights of public safety employees is a case called Thorne, that's T-H-O-R-N-E, versus City of El Segundo. It's an old case now, 1983, but it's still quoted all the time. Thorne involved a applicant for a job as a police officer. And in the course of the application process, the employer asked all sorts of questions about whether or not Thorne had an affair with a police officer, and had asked about some general questions about her off, not off duty because she was an applicant, but about her sexual conduct in the past. And that case went all the way up to the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals, which very significantly held that the applicant has a privacy rights and a right in that sort of information, and that it was inappropriate for the employer to ask absent any sort of direct correlation with the job. Now, Thorne, as I've mentioned, has been cited many, many times, still good law, and that's the backdrop against which the case of Janelle Perez is being considered. Perez is a probationary police officer with the city of Roseville, California. She's in her initial training rotation, and a few months into her patrol assignment, she and another officer, an officer by the name of Shag Bagley, and I didn't make that up, initiated a personal relationship. Perez and Bagley were both separated from, but still legally married to other individuals. Bagley's wife finds out about this, and she files a citizen complaint alleging that Perez and Bagley were not only having an affair, but suggesting as well that they were engaged in sex on duty. Roseville's IA unit opens an investigation. A lieutenant ends up concluding that there was no evidence of on-duty sexual conduct between Perez and Bagley, but that Perez and Bagley did make a number of calls and texts while one or both were on duty, and that these were potentially violations of department policy. The department then ends sends a memo. It's called a findings memo in the department, indicating that the policy violations of making these phone calls and texting while on duty were sustained, concluding that their activities interfered with their work performance and that their personal relationship impacted and reflected unfavorably upon the department. Perez and Bagley both got reprimands for that. Perez decides to appeal the reprimand and goes to a hearing with the police chief and comes out being fired. May not have been a good appeal decision. The police chief decides at the end of the appeal of the reprimand, ends up deciding that really, instead of the reprimand, she's not going to make it as a police officer here, and releases her from probation. Perez then sues the city, citing Thorne versus El Segundo, saying that her private sexual activities were protected by the Constitution from the city's internal affairs investigation and from the discharge. And that goes to the California Court of Appeals, which sides with the city. And the court, you know, of course, has to spend most of its time dealing with the Thorne case. And the court says, look, Thorne was different than Perez. Here, Perez was engaged in on-duty activity, and her on-duty activity resulted in an IA complaint being filed. The Ninth Circuit in Thorne dealt with the absence of any showing that the applicant's private off-duty personal activities had any impact on the city. Says the court in Perez's case, and I'm quoting, the IA investigation into Perez's conduct resulted from a citizen complaint that suggested Perez was engaged in a personal relationship with Bagley while on duty, underlining those words. Therefore, Perez's alleged right to privacy was not clearly established, and her privacy claim should be dismissed. Actually, I think that's probably a good ruling. You see courts kind of all over the map on these sex cases, and it really depends a lot, I think, on the the judge, or in this case, the panel of judges that you get. I can imagine a court going the other way on this one, because, of course, it ends to begin with only with a reprimand, the investigation does. So, therefore, how much of an adverse impact on the employer could there be? But nonetheless, I do think the court's basic point that there is no privacy right associated with on-duty romantic or sexual behavior, I think that basic point is very sound. I want to conclude this podcast by talking about my last two cases. They're both Brady cases. We're just getting walloped upside the head right now with these Brady cases. They're coming down so fast. The first of these cases, which comes out of Kansas, is a case where an officer lied during the first part of an IA interview, and then in the middle of the interview, corrected the lie, and did so on an unprompted basis. He was still fired for untruthfulness, and those are the facts that go to the arbitrator. You see this one all the time, right? It's probably come up in your agency once or twice, or more than once or twice, where an officer during the middle, or an officer or a firefighter, any public employee, during the middle of an IA investigation kind of gets religion and realizes that they may be converting what could have been a written reprimand into a discharge by lying about it. So what goes on in this case? And this involves an officer, and we don't know his name. This is an odd artifact of arbitration decisions that you see published in what's known as the Labor Arbitration Reporter. That's put out by the Bureau of National Affairs. In discipline cases, they only identify people by initials in those reports. So all that we know is that this case involves Officer M. All right, so what happens here? And it's a pretty recent case. The facts here occur in December of 2013. The Hutchinson, Kansas Police Department, gets a complaint from an individual who says basically this: one of your officers arrested me for a DWI violation, and then later came to my house, telephoned me at home, sent me text messages, and generally engaged in harassing conduct. The department, of course, opens an investigation, interviews the officer. This is not our Officer M. He will come into the play later. Interviews the officer, who admitted visiting the home of the complainant after the DWI arrest to follow up on the arrest. The officer tells IA the complainant made sexual advances, and I shared that story with other officers. The officer even admits that he might have, these are his words, amped up the story, and that he told another officer, who he identifies as Officer M, that he, quote, got a blowjob from the complainant. The officer denies to IA that he actually did receive oral sex, told the investigator he didn't have any sexual contact with the complainant other than an advance that she made to him when she attempted to grab his crotch. He rebuffed her, he said. So he's basically saying, look, I puffed up this story when I was talking with my fellow officers. And the officer says, when I communicated this with Officer M, I not only told him, but I actually sent him a text message. And the department searches the officer's cell phone, finds the record of the text message to Officer M, and now the city is interviewing Officer M. In the first part of the interview, Officer M denies reading the text message. He lies. Later in the interview, he admitted reading the text message, and when asked why he lied, he said, and this is a quote, because I didn't want to get anybody else in trouble. I didn't want to be part of it. The city fires Officer M for dishonesty, and that's what goes to arbitration, and the arbitrator overturns the termination. Why does the arbitrator overturn the termination? The arbitrator ends up being very impressed with Officer M. He says, I think it's significant that Officer M decided during the course of the interview to admit to the truth and also admit that he had lied. And these are the words of the arbitrator. Officer M's about face in his interview shows that he's capable of understanding that for a police officer, loyalty to a friend can only go so far, that the duties and responsibilities of his job require that he reveal whatever he knows about wrongdoing without regard to the consequences of who may be affected. The present experience has brought home to Officer M the cost of trying to help a friend, that the cost of trying to help a friend can be the loss of his job. The arbitrator ends up saying, look, Officer M has learned and taken this matter to heart. Well, the city isn't quite done. The city says, look, we've got a couple of other things that we've got to say. They call a captain to the witness stand. And the captain says, I can no longer trust Officer M because he lied in his interview. The arbitrator isn't too impressed with that. These are the words of the arbitrator. The implication of such a position on the captain's part is that once somebody lies, that person cannot be believed in the future. The arbitrator does not believe that there is any valid psychological or logical basis to such a stance, nor has the department conducted itself on that principle in the recent past. And then we have the second argument. You know what it's going to be, right? It's going to be Brady. The city points to a letter that the local district attorney wrote saying he would not use Officer M as a witness in any criminal prosecution unless it would be absolutely necessary to do so to avoid a gross miscarriage of justice or to protect the community's safety from a real threat. Can I pause for a moment? Really? When you're writing letters like that, you have to be more careful, don't you? I mean, really, you're not going to use them as a witness except to prevent a gross miscarriage of justice? So that means you would decline to use them as a witness if the only thing would be a slight miscarriage of justice? Or maybe a big miscarriage of justice, but not a gross one? Or, I mean, the notion that I would never use them as a witness unless there would be a, quote, real threat to the community's safety, as opposed to an unreal threat. I'm sorry, I just find these, and I've seen a lot of these letters, I just think prosecutors need to spend more care on these sorts of letters. Well, what does the arbitrator think about all this? And the arbitrator says, you know what? I think that district attorney's letter isn't worth a whole lot. And by the way, this is an arbitrator who clearly has a lot of trial experience. From what I'm about to just read you, you'll see that trial experience come through. The arbitrator says the DA's letter doesn't fully understand the Brady rule. Why? The arbitrator says the letter, and here I'm quoting, doesn't discuss the possibility, or perhaps likelihood, that if turned over to the judge would rule that the incident in question was not a basis for impeachment, and that defense counsel could not question Officer M concerning it. One must ask why the DA would not use Officer M as a witness if he were not required to submit the information about his misconduct to the judge for a ruling on whether the information should be turned over to defense counsel. If Officer M were the arresting officer in the case and had material evidence concerning the alleged crime, how could the DA justify not calling him as a witness? Is the DA aware of Officer M's prior commendable record as a police officer with the department? the arbitrator goes on and on from there, but I think you get the drift. And the arbitrator ends up saying, look, I've looked at Kansas law. And he does a pretty impressive review of the various statutes on impeachment of witnesses. And it is clear to me that Officer M's dishonesty in this IA investigation isn't impeachable evidence in a criminal case. Therefore, the Brady rule doesn't justify the officer's discharge. What does the officer do by way of remedy? Well, it turns out that there were a bunch of officers who knew about the allegations about oral sex and everything like that. The city gave some of them oral reprimands, verbal warnings. And that's what the arbitrator says the discharge of Officer M should be converted to. A verbal warning that would include a final warning with regard to any future failure to be truthful in the performance of police duties. Otherwise, Officer M has to be made whole for all lost wages and benefits. Pretty significant case, right? And we are starting to see, and by starting, I mean we're now, well, 3 years into this, we are starting to see arbitrators and courts question placement on a Brady list or letters like this from a district attorney asked, they're questioning the underlying basis for those letters. And not just questioning them, but they're deciding in some cases there is no basis for them. What's our last case? This comes to us from a Supreme Court. This is the New Hampshire Supreme Court, and it involves kind of a separate Brady list question. So what happens when you have an officer who is disciplined for some dishonesty-related event, and the local district attorney is notified that the discipline has occurred, places the officer on a Brady list. In the meantime, the officer's union challenges the discipline in arbitration, and the arbitration overturns the discipline, what happens then? Does the officer get removed from the Brady list? And this is actually the first time I've seen that precise issue litigated anywhere in the country. Just as a word of aside, if you go to this case, and we try to link to all these cases on our webpage, you will see that in New Hampshire, what we think of elsewhere as the Brady list is actually called the Lorry list. And that comes from a decision of the New Hampshire Supreme Court in a case called State versus Lorry. Same difference, though. It's really the same thing. A Lorry list, like a Brady list, is a list of officers who have something in their personnel files where a DA believes that there might have to be disclosure in a criminal case. So what goes on in this case? These are three officers who are working for the Manchester, New Hampshire Police Department. They're off duty, and they're involved in a fracas at a bar in Manchester, as sometimes happens with bar fracases or fraci or whatever you say, involving law enforcement officers. The incident gets widely reported in the media, and the Manchester Chief of Police orders both a criminal investigation and an IA investigation. The IA investigation concludes that the officers have violated several departmental policies, including one prohibiting the use of force, unnecessary use of force, and suspends each of the officers for a period of time. The chief then sends a letter to the DA's office, it's called the Hillsborough County Attorney's Office, saying that the officers have been disciplined, and the county attorney places the officer's name on the Brady list, or Lorry list. The officers then file grievances, they go to arbitration, and the arbitrator says, no just cause for the discipline, and orders that the officers be made whole for all lost wages and benefits. Another thing that happens in the interim is the New Hampshire AG's office conducts the criminal investigation that the chief requested and concluded that the officer's conduct in the bar was justified under New Hampshire law and no criminal charges are warranted. So after the arbitration decision and the report from the AG's office, the chief writes to the county attorney, the DA, saying, look, remove these people from the Brady list. The county attorney says no. And I have made the judgment, says the county attorney, that this is a disclosable offense regardless of what the AG says and regardless of what an arbitrator says. The officers then file a lawsuit. They ask for, it's called a writ of mandamus in New Hampshire, trying to compel the county attorney to remove their names from the Brady list. They also tack on a due process claim saying that the refusal to remove them from the list violated their constitutional rights to due process of law. And that's the case that goes to the New Hampshire Supreme Court. And on reasoning that is a little bit muddy to me, even after rereading the opinion, the court sides with the officers and orders the county attorney to remove them from the Brady list. Why do I say the reasoning is mudding? I'm not quite sure what the underlying basis is to order the removal. It doesn't sound like a due process issue to me. If it was due process, really all that the DA would need to do would be to grant the officers the right to write him a letter or try to convince him to take him off the list. But due process wouldn't give a court the right to compel the county attorney from taking or from compel them, the county attorney, to take the officers' names off the list. So there's a little bit of unclarity as to why it is the court does what it does. But it's completely clear as to what the court is feeling about the whole thing concerning Brady lists. And the court has 2 points. First of all, the court says the only thing that's at issue here is the officer's involvement in a single incident of excessive force. No suggestion that they were dishonest. No suggestion that they tried to cover up their conduct. And even if the use of force accusation were true, this incident, without anything more, like lying, would not be admissible to impeach the officer's credibility. Isn't that what the arbitrator in Kansas I just talked about said? We have here a state Supreme Court looking into the underlying rationale of whether, in fact, this piece of information, whatever this piece of information is, could be used for impeachment purposes. The court even goes further with that. It says, look, even if a future case were to arise where a claim of excessive use of force was made against one of the officers, the prior incident wouldn't be admissible to show a propensity to engage in such conduct. There's nothing impeachable about this incident, says the court. Now, what's the second rationale from the court? The court says, more importantly, although the officers were initially disciplined by the police chief, that decision was overturned by an arbitrator who's a neutral fact finder following a full hearing conducted pursuant to the procedures agreed to in the contract. The AG also concluded that the use of force was justified. And as a result of these determinations, everything's been removed from the officer's personnel files. There is no basis, no sustained basis, to keep these officers' names on the Brady list. And here's the closing quote from the court. It makes no sense that the threshold determination that something was thought to be potentially exculpatory and worthy of an in-camera review by the court but has now been shown not to be of that character, should follow the officers every time they appear as witnesses. And the court orders county attorney to remove the officers' names from the Brady list or the Lori list. These two cases are examples of the continuing unease that courts are feeling. I started off the podcast with this. The courts are feeling about Brady lists. You see this time and time again, this notion that prosecutors are putting officers on Brady lists too easily without enough thought as to whether the underlying offense really would be impeachable and really would prevent the successful prosecution of a suspect. Courts are getting very leery of the possibility that there could be other reasons why a prosecutor would be putting an officer on a Brady list. What other reasons? Reasons, for example, of making a judgment about the officer's underlying conduct. That's not the place for a prosecutor. Reasons about a concern as to whether or not an arbitrator reached a right result. That's not the concern of an arbitrator. The only concern, these courts say, is whether or not the officer's underlying conduct in fact would produce damaging impeachment evidence. Well, that's it for our August 1st Thursday podcast. Hope to see you again or talk to you again in September. Remember, we're going to have an interview with Steve Buchady, more on the Brady list in case you just can't get enough of it. And we also hope to see you in September in Las Vegas for our grievances and past practice seminar, our 3-day seminar where we kind of take apart the whole notion of how grievances are processed and decided by arbitrators and what the meaning is of past practice and how it can bind an employer with respect to making changes in policies and procedures. With that, this is Will Aitchison signing off. Have a good rest of the summer, folks.